Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey nerds, welcome to episode 520 something of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam all by myself today. We've hit a number where I can't keep track anymore. I think it's 524 maybe. Does it really matter? I don't think you guys probably care what number it is. That's okay. You can find all of that at professionalbooknerds.com. Today's episode is an interview I did with wonderful New Zealand author Elizabeth Knox. We are a global podcast. Last week I had a podcast interview with Genevieve Gornishek, who lives for all intents and purposes basically around the corner from me here in the Cleveland area. And then this week we have Elizabeth, who is, I looked it up, 8,600 miles from where I am currently sitting to where she was currently sitting, or rather sitting when we chatted. She has a new novel out called The Absolute Book, and it is perfect. A good friend of the show, our buddy on Instagram, Tina, who runs TBR, etc., which is an Instagram account you should be following if you're not, because it's lovely. She and I were talking about this book, and she's like, wow, that is such an Adam book. And she hit the nail on the head. The Absolute Book is a wonderful story that is filled with sweeping takes on fairies and multiple worlds and demons and Norse mythology. And there's so much in here. It's very much, if you're a fan of Neil Gaiman's writing, you will love this book. It's just, gosh, I love this book so much. I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. We get all into the plot and how she put together this story and how The Absolute Book came from trying to deal with a family tragedy that she was trying to come to terms with. We talk a lot about the plot in this particular episode. I hesitate to say that there's any spoilers, just because even if you know the exact plot of this book, you will still get just heaps of enjoyment from reading it. I am already thinking about my next read of this book. It's just one of those stories where it stuck with me, and there's so much that I want to dive back into. For fans of Reading Glasses and us, this is a big book about a book type of a novel, so everyone loves that. It's got a lot of library love in there. There's just so much goodness in this, and Elizabeth was lovely to chat with. We talk a little bit about Peter Jackson because she has a connection, and also she's from New Zealand. So of course we have to talk about Lord of the Rings, and Flight of the Conchords for at least a moment. We also talk about how our respective countries have been dealing with the pandemic, and just all, it's interesting. It's a really good conversation. And as you can probably imagine, yes, of course my dogs bark at some point throughout the chat. That's just what happens now. I don't think I'm going to keep you guys any longer with the introduction, because I want you to get to this conversation. But if you're enjoying the podcast and you haven't yet left us a review somewhere, we would appreciate that, whether it's iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast. You can always find us on Twitter and Instagram at Pro Book Nerds. If you listened to our most recent episode, we talked about our Professional Book Nerds Reading Challenge. Jill and I shared some cookbooks that we like and some recipes. And if you're partaking in our Professional Book Nerds Reading Challenge, which you can find at professionalbooknerds.com, definitely be sure to tag us on Instagram and Twitter with all of your challenges that you tackle, but especially we want to see some recipes you put together with any cookbooks you might be loving. Okay, that's everything. I'm going to let you get to this just splendid conversation with Elizabeth Knox, author of The Absolute Book, on the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, why, where it came from and how it ended up with the kind of tone and shape it has. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell you what, we can just do that right now, because I've got the recording and I can kind of edit out the beginning aspects. So Elizabeth, can you just sort of introduce our readers, or our listeners rather, to The Absolute Book, a book that they absolutely need to check out because it's wonderful. So what would be an introduction that you would say to this story?
Well, I started writing it because I had come out of a very difficult period in my life where my mother was dying of ALS and my husband's brother was killed deliberately by somebody. And we had a lot of people to look after for about a 3-year period. And coming out of that, we were very kind of weightless and buoyant and relieved. And I got this feeling about being able to walk away from the trouble without feeling that you'd done anything wrong, that you'd done everything right. And I wanted to capture that, but I also wanted to talk about my feelings about my brother-in-law's death, in as much as the man who killed him was tried for manslaughter rather than murder because you couldn't prove intent. So I thought I would just give that story to my heroine. So her sister is killed by somebody who can only be tried for manslaughter. And that kind of messes up her head, my Taryn's head. She can't let it go. Her confidence in the world is very shaken, as it is if you have someone near to you who dies by violence, your confidence in the world is shaken. And she seeks revenge. And that messes up her life even more. So I wanted to start with this person who was kind of broken and who I wanted to recover, who I wanted to be able to explore that feeling of coming out of something, being able to do the right things finally and coming out of, you know, a time of trouble. But I didn't have any framework. So then I started thinking about the kind of stories that I liked, but wanted to improve upon. Like, so I love what I call arcane thrillers, things like Kate Moss's Labyrinth or Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. I love that kind of book because I like the scholarly hero of those books. So I thought, all right, my heroine Taryn's going to be a scholarly hero. And then I decided that the thing that sometimes disappointed me with those books is when they suggest vast mystical things and there isn't anything vast and mystical. So I thought, right, well, this is going to start like an arcane thriller with a scholarly hero looking for something, a troubled scholarly hero. And but there really will be, you know, gods and demons and so forth. And she's going to sort of basically stumble through into other worlds and the world's going to expand and expand. But I wanted it, so I wanted it to be an epic, but I wanted it to also double back and deepen the life of its characters, more like a mystery than an epic. So it's what I call an intimate epic because it expands, but it always keeps coming back into and people who've apparently been lost or disappeared in the story come back, and you know, there's suddenly someone turns up again, you know, like 20 years later in a bookshop, here is the person who tried to burn down the library, you know.
There is so much in this book that I want to unpack because I want to come back to the original kind of opening of the story, like you mentioned, sort of this violent act that is hard to prove intent for, but the book opens up in this very sort of grounded tragic aspect and then unfolds into, I mean, there's aspects of Dante in here and Norse gods, and there's fairy in this, there's so much going on. And so when you first started writing this story, did it start as almost like a cathartic release of those emotions that you were feeling from the tragedy that your family went through and then sort of unfolded from there? Or did you always know, okay, I'm going to kind of mushroom cloud, I guess, this whole story out into the fantastical aspects of it?
I did know that I always wanted to write a book like that. And that has to do with the tone. Like, one of my favorite books is Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, the modernist Russian masterpiece. And one of the things I like most about that book is the fact that it doesn't mind being hilarious and farcical at the same time as being sort of beautiful and grand and sad. Like it does the mixed tone. I always think of Buffy the Vampire Slayer too, that Buffy didn't mind being grand, didn't mind being sad, didn't mind being gritty and then silly. And yeah, so I wanted something that could do that too. So that was another thing about the epicness, was not kind of sticking to one sort of tone, but letting the atmosphere, just the sense of expanding mysteries and that nothing is lost. Mm-hmm. You know, both those two things together are kind of they're thematic, but they sort of run like atmosphere too through the whole thing. It's just the mood of the book. So yeah, that was my intention with it.
Yeah, it's strange to say that a book that features Odin and his ravens and a fairyland and hell and all these different demons and angels and aspects feels very grounded, but it does because of the emotions of your main character. You know, we keep coming back to her sister who died, and the fact that even as she's going through these otherworldly emotions in these places that are idyllic, and she's exploring this world where in theory she could live for hundreds of years in like the best possible ways, she's still always kind of, it doesn't really get resolved until the very end of the book, her feelings about her sister. So keeping that through line does it, it feels very grounded. But can you walk me through maybe how this story takes shape for you as a writer? Because I'm afraid to almost ask if you wrote this linearly, because I feel like that can't possibly be how it came to be. But how did you put this story together?
I did write it linear fashion. Yeah, I wrote it. I found my way into the story, having an idea of what kind of story I wanted to tell. And then after that, it's you sort of have an inner choreographer that tells you where to put your feet, so to speak, as you're writing. And you know, there are points where you're writing a book like that where you have to pause and go, all right, well, you know, why is this bit not working? And then, you know, I always run through my checklist because I'm quite experienced, you know, so yeah, I run through my checklist, you know, is it point of view? Does this bit need to be told by the other narrator, or is it tone? Is it whatever? But I think the fun for me in the story was kind of discovering what I could do. And I knew I was going to have purgatory towards the end of the book, an expedition into purgatory. And that was kind of, you know, a big node of meaning. You know, important things were going to happen. So I knew I was heading that way. And I also knew that because Taryn's revenge had involved someone else and she'd damaged this person's life, it wasn't just going to be about her feelings of guilt. This guy was literally going to turn up, you know, he was, it was the bad penny, and that had to happen. So that was the kind of thriller component. And I knew that running through the whole book, there's what's called the green prayer, the green pressure, that the whole time, you never know the main character, apart from Taryn, is a non-point of view character, that Shift, who's not human in any way, shape or form. And he has a thing he's being asked to do throughout the whole book, but you only gradually become aware that there are forces asking him to do something. So he's not a person who thinks, well, there's something I have to do and I'm looking for the means to do it. He's looking without any idea that he can do the thing he's being asked to do. And that kind of runs throughout. That's a kind of a hidden theme, but it's hidden because the book also is about things being hidden. I mean, the object that everyone's looking for hides itself, and Shift has a spell on him that means that people can't see him properly. And, you know, so it runs its hidden theme. Wow, it's revealing. So it's revealing things. Yeah. Well,
and the reason I asked about it being a linear story is because the story itself doesn't feel truly linear to me in a good way. It reminds me of like a role-playing video game where there's side quests and there's little things. Yes. It's almost like, it's strange to say a book is an open world story, but to me, that's what it felt like, because we would meet, the main characters go through a certain aspect of your story, and then maybe we meet someone, and then we spend a long time in that particular person who we just met's kind of like backstory or how they came to be.
They tell a story, which is their memory keepers for Shift.
Yeah.
So they've learned these stories that are his stories, like how I met this person, and they're kind of supposed to pass on information to someone else who might have to keep that story. So because he forgets everything. So there's that. But yeah, I love your comparing it to an open world adventure in a game, because my son's a very keen gamer, and I've spent a long time listening to him talk about the virtues of open world, that, you know, you can go, well, there is the quest waiting for me, but meanwhile, I'm going to go and hunt some bears, or, you know, do some fishing. I'm thinking of Red Dead Redemption here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm playing a Zelda game right now, and it feels like the same way. It's the same thing. It's like you can just get lost in these other places. But I love a book like that, because it makes you feel like, I think so often when people read stories and they read books, they're just trying to get to what is the end point. And this one, it just feels like the point of the, obviously there is a driving force, which you see, we kind of learn very late in the book, like what is really the driving force behind what we think is the driving force. I'm being very vague because I want people to really like come into the book fresh, but it just feels like the point of the story you're trying to show was come and explore this world. Come and see these different layers of this universe I've built out. And I don't know, to me, it's just every time I met a new aspect, like when you meet a bird and you discover like, oh, this is one of Odin's ravens. And like, you, like, there's these little characters that get dropped in where it feels like you're leaving like breadcrumbs around a path just to say like, come explore and stay for a while. Like, was there an overarching thing that you wanted people to take away? Cause there are absolutely sort of like political and like global aspects of this that people will come to feel, but like, are there things you wanted people to take away from the book that maybe weren't directly connected to the plot?
Yes, I think the main thing was because it runs towards the end like a wish fulfillment fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to cause the I'm trying to please people. I'm trying to make them happy towards the end of the book, because because things work out for the characters, and because it's all hard won, and you know, it's got a recovery narrative in there of Taryn coming back to life after all her troubles. But what I wanted to do was make people think about what they were wishing for. And to do that, you've kind of got to be leave things to be a bit unstable and uneasy. So lots of people can go, oh, wow, that was wonderful how the world got saved. And other people go like, yes, but nothing like that's going to happen to us. And but my idea is to think, well, what are you wishing for? You're wishing for somebody to take charge of certain things and say, no, these matters are urgent. We have to do something about them, and we have to change our lives. And, you know, governments can do that pretty much. And, you know, I'm a New Zealander, and we're relatively COVID free. And that was because our government just basically took things in hand and said, all right, we're going to act like the good parents and protect you. Yeah. So yeah. I was kind of interested in that idea of making people sort of feel a wish and then look around and go, yeah, all right, well, if that's what we want and need, how do we get that? So that was sort of a serious intention, but it's much less serious than my aim to startle and please and, you know, and divert and transport people.
I looked it up. I was laughing because it just so happened the author who was on last week, a week ago when this episode comes out, happened to live in the city that I live in, about 20 minutes from my house. And I looked it up. You and I are 8,600 miles apart. So that's, it is, we're worlds apart, and getting to sort of the COVID aspect of, I mean, I know that this book isn't written as like a COVID response, but
it was written before. So
exactly. Yeah, but I mean, a thing that struck me is thinking about the juxtaposition of how the United States was handling the pandemic, which falling flat on its face, and how New Zealand handled it. It kind of reminds me, there's a part in the book, it's almost like a singular line that it really stuck with me. And I wanted to bring it up because I haven't heard other authors address anything like this before. You talk about Odin, how he sees his followers. My dog's about to bark at something.
Yes, Jacob guessing what has happened to.
Yeah, there's a dog outside. There's a dog that had the nerve to be outside.
It's narrative. Just, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I can edit all of Remy's little low growling. Hey, go. Let me see if I can get him to be quiet real quick. How dare that dog? I know. there's a part, it's really quick in the book where
Jacob and Nev talking about she says, you know, gods get corrupted by their foot.
Yeah, how gods get corrupted
and
by their
foot. This is why. What's happened to Odin?
Yeah, because a lot of white supremacists are getting Norse tattoos.
Yeah, yeah. So he says, so you mean the line is, you mean white supremacists with Volk nuts tattooed on their man boobs? Because Jacob's very disparaging of anyone that he disapproves of. So he just sort of just lays on in there.
But the thing that I thought was really interesting about it is because I haven't really seen an idea like this before where gods are affected by their followers and how like their followers believe. Because there's American Gods by Neil Gaiman, but that's more so like a specific type of God is created by the thing that people like television is a quote unquote God. And it's a very like unique way of looking at them. But I really love, like, was this something where you wanted to put into your story? Like, the way that people follow, because there's followers in your book in the sense that like each of the kind of fey people have sort of followers that kind of make up their,
entourage. Yes.
Yeah. But was it important to you to kind of look at that, like the way people view gods and perhaps kind of turning it on its head?
I was interested in the idea that gods are enormously powerful but very permeable and open to influence, and why they are gods is because they have this sort of, you know, you could call they're kind of a species of being that is affected by how they're worshipped. Mm-hmm. And I got the idea from the sort of germ of the idea from Heinrich Heine's book, The Gods in Exile. It's, mm-hmm. you know, the German writer. So it was written in the middle of the 19th century, but it could have been the 18th century. Anyway, I read it when I was very young and it stuck in my head. And so, like I do, I think, well, if this was true of gods, how would that express itself? And so what I was interested in specifically in the story was that the Green Prayer being directed at Shift turns him from being kind of a semi-detached god mm-hmm. and being sort of a real god mm-hmm. gradually. So, so in order for that to happen, I needed the reader to understand it. So I had to sort of, you know, using Odin as an example. And Odin was a good example because I'm quite keen on Odin and Odin's ravens, obviously, and it's been a bit vexing watching how that's been kind of co-opted by the white supremacists. It's like, oh, leave that alone, put that down.
Come up with your own thing. Don't use this. We are all
Viking romance stuff. It's like,
but I do. Okay, I want to focus on shift for a second, which is a weird way of saying that.
It's hard.
Yeah, he is such Shift is such a unique character in the sense that what I really like about this character is the name Shift really kind of defines as well, like the way that he can't really be seen directly and he can change shape. But it's also the name works kind of on two levels, because we discover things about him slowly throughout the book and we learn more and more about him. Like, how did you go about creating the rules for Shift's existence? Because they are very malleable and they are very, he can do so many things. Like, did you ever worry about giving Shift too much power or not enough? Like, did you worry about the rules?
Now that's always a question when you've got a character who's capable of a lot his story is self-limits his power, really. Mm-hmm. The fact that he's been compelled to hide himself,
right,
and he doesn't really have a choice, that's kind of completely meshed into with his nature. The fact that he's hidden, that he's also compelled by the spell that hides him to keep himself hidden. So he doesn't show his metal very often. Mm-hmm. And it's not repression with him. But you do get a glimpse towards the end of the book of what he'd be like if he wasn't quite so trammeled. And you're supposed to be a little uneasy and think, whoa, dynamite, you know, that's gonna be difficult. But yeah, that was just where I wanted to kind of, you know, leave it. Say, well, there's consequences even to wanting somebody to be free of something.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask, because I think I saw you mention this briefly. Anyone who writes fantasy and is from New Zealand is, of course, it's a rule that I have to ask you a Lord of the Rings question of some sort.
Yes.
So, like,
big fan.
You have had an interaction with Peter Jackson, correct?
Yeah, I've actually had several interactions with Peter Jackson. My Peter's wife Fran was a bit of a childhood friend of my husband's. So, you know, when they meet each other, they go, like, "Oh, you remember when this, or you remember when that?" So it's like, yeah, but you don't bump into him in the course of things. He's, you know, he's got a parallel existence and powerful land.
Of course, yeah, but So do you ever get tired as a New Zealander? I feel like the questions anyone must ask you outside of your own work is something about Lord of the Rings or something about Flight of the Conchords. Like, is there any like,
no, those Conchords too. Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, you have to grow tired of people asking you about like Hobbiton and different places like that, especially as
see, the thing is, the relevant question now would be about Taika.
Mm-hmm. That's
because you see, Taika is a classic with the mixed tone. You see, mm-hmm. I love mixed tone work. Like, he can make you cry one minute and laugh like crazy the next. He's just so good at it. So yeah. So I'm just waiting for the time when we automatically get asked about Taika.
I have to imagine it's got to be pretty soon. I will say that, like, the Flight of the Conchords show, I know at least in my group of friends, like, that was like, that just kind of, it's such a tone, like, their comedy is such a specific tone that it's just like, it comes out of left field. And, but you're absolutely right with Taika, like, he's so wide ranging. But I just, what types of books did you enjoy kind of growing up, and what types of books do you find yourself reading? Like, do you, especially when working on a book like The Absolute Book, which is so, there's so much different types of fantasy and mythology in here. Do you find yourself reading those types of books while you're working on things, or do you kind of steer clear of those types of genres while you're working?
I tend not to read fiction when I'm deeply involved in a book, you know, writing a novel. So, I mean, I go in waves with the writing, so I kind of write in great bursts. So that leaves me time in between to read all the novels that start accumulating. But when I'm writing fiction, I don't tend to read fiction, but then I really, really like essays and...
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much what I read. But I read widely. I read a lot of literary fiction, and I read. I love young adult fantasy, but it got very mainstream, which meant that it wasn't full of the absolute very best people struggling to put their heads up above the parapet anymore. those people, then J.K. Rowling became the wave that bore everyone else up. And now I'm kind of like sorting around looking for the very literary stuff or the very, very unusual, exciting stuff. But I always think the best fantasy is often in young adult books.
Yeah, and I know what you mean about kind of like the unexpected. I think one of the reasons that your book has stuck with me so much is I think one of the biggest challenges for a fantasy novel is when you are building a world, which you build several worlds in this book. When you're doing that as a reader, part of the fun of the mystery is uncovering the rules of the world and what's going to happen. And then I think a lot of times what can happen in young adult and adult fantasy is it can get a little like, once the reveal happens and you know that the hero is going to be successful, you feel like you're just kind of like, okay, well, let's just get this over with. Whereas yours, it's like, you really hold on into that really final page before the epilogue to kind of unveil or, you know, reveal what's going on. And I do think that is something where, when writing fantasy, do you feel like you first have to establish a world and then tell a story, or, you know, how do you find that challenging? I mean, obviously this is
I think it's simultaneous. I think that the world that you're building, which has to feel like a material world with rules that are scientific. I mean, even your magic has to feel scientific, but also everything else in the world, you know, your sort of social conditions, how money works, how people feel about their neighbors, all of that feeds in, but it comes while you're writing, and it comes where you go, you've invented one thing, and then you go, well, if this was true, what would that mean? And then the next invention comes out of that. And then so on. It just sort of feeds through. I call it, when I'm talking to, I teach world building at a course at university. I call it consequential invention, that each invention is a consequence of something else that's already been invented. So it's not quite that it shouldn't feel like layering. It should feel like part of the narrative. It's the narrative that requires the inventions.
Is it, and so not to like mix metaphors and naming conventions, but it's almost like to me it feels a little bit like Chekhov's gun, what they say about in the theater. You know, if you put a gun on the stage, it better go off before the end.
For me, it's Chekhov's forest, isn't it?
I was just gonna say, like, for this book, it's almost like, do you think when you're writing fantasy, it's like, okay, if I create this rule, which I emphasize early on, it better play a part at the end, or else you're just kind of like, it just leaves people flat. Like, are you thinking about how these magical rule sets and the physics of the world are going to affect the end? And I mean, granted, like you said, they end up going to purgatory, which we can kind of, you can flip all the rules on its head again, but are you thinking about that when you're building, writing a story kind of linearly like this? Now I'm in my head about saying linearly so many times.
I don't know how you say that.
I don't know. I think I run out of times, but are you thinking about how the rules of your worlds are going to affect the ending when you're starting, or is that something you really don't concern yourself with in like kind of the first draft?
It makes sense to me as I'm going on, like, what are the important things to know? And there are several things that get mentioned slightly offhand and dismissively because people are embarrassed about them. Very, very early on when somebody is explaining what the fairy people are able to do, and someone mentions glamours and then kind of sweeps it under the carpet because they're all, it's a fairly disgraceful practice. And you don't see how incredibly powerful that is until you see it exercised at the end of the book. And that was just to kind of like, oh, I'm going to have some real fun here with the point of view, like, so I do think you can't just kind of make something up and not use it. So I do try to use everything, but then I also try to purposely make it clear that sometimes you're opening a gate where the reader can be able to imagine the consequences of that particular thing that happened beyond the end of the story. Mm. So when Shift makes the garden in purgatory at the end, he says, I think one day it might be a gate, you know, he says that. And then that just, I want my readers to do is go away thinking, yes, but a gate to where? Because by that time they've sort of got quite a strong idea about fairy gates and what right. they do. And so I like to be able to give people something to sort of spin out from the end of things, just because then it will feel like it's theirs, and you know they've been stimulated in some further invention. Yeah,
and it also, I mean, it for me especially, that the way that you have it end like that, it keeps you thinking about the book and the story long after. I always think through movies, you know, what happens after the story ends. You know, I think there's like a book or a movie that's like after, like, you know, a lot of people like to say like after Happily Ever After, but it's like, it keeps you thinking about the things that are happening. What was the most challenging aspect of writing this novel for you?
Oh, you know, what was going to give it? Well, every novel I'm writing gets down to a point where you're writing the last quarter of it, or third quarter, depends on the length of the novel, where absolutely everything that has to happen has to work. Mm-hmm. So I got to the purgatory chapter and I thought, well, if I can't make this work, then the novel won't work. And then I got to the chapter after that, where Nev tells her story. I thought, well, if I can't make that work, it's not going to work. And then the chapter that's set in Tintern, in England. Mm-hmm. And so it was just one thing after another. So it's usually the fact that you start a story and you've got lots of decisions to make. Mm-hmm. And then as the story goes on, there are fewer and fewer decisions that are available for you. And that's when it becomes like, I guess it's like chess with only a few pieces left on the board, maybe. As opposed to chess at the beginning, you know, you make your opening gambit. So, I guess that was all a challenge. But having said that, I wanted the thriller chapter, the chapter that's on the estuary where all Taryn's chickens come home to roost, you know, after the bad thing she's done. Mm-hmm. I wanted that to sort of read a bit like, you know, suddenly Lee Child was in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
So I was going like, this chapter will be thriller. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's one of the many, many fun things about this book is depending on, like, you could, once you read the book once through, you'll want to pick it back up and just open to a random chapter. And depending on what chapter you open on, you're reading a thriller or you're reading a fairy tale or you're reading a mystery. And it's all packed into here. And it's just, I don't know, I haven't been able to stop thinking about this book because you weave in all of these different genres so much, which is why I asked you about what you read. And I definitely understand you saying you read all genres because they're all.
Yeah, I sure do. Yeah. No, I love genres and I love looking at them and thinking, you know, what could I do with this? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I can't, like, there's some genres I love, right? Right. Like, yeah, that's not available to me.
Yeah.
But I think that was part of my idea about making, like, the book's message being that the world, everything is big and interconnected. Mm-hmm. And one way of doing that when you're writing fiction is to not make it one kind of book. Mm-hmm. Say there are many kinds of things, like, you know, Shift calls everything people. Like he says very early on that, you know, that demons are people and that his chickens are people. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's a person to him. And so it's that kind of even-handed inclusiveness. You can make the book also do that by you know, going, yay, I'm now going to stick my feet in this genre. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it, you know, I was doing it with gusto. I wasn't doing it going, oh, you know, I'm going to show them or anything like that, because I really never think that. Usually I'm just mm-hmm. trying to enjoy myself and get it right.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, and as a reader, I always hate when someone tries to, it's so like people try to put books into a genre, like neat little cubby, and so few books really do fit in one. And it's so much more fun to just understand, like, you read a book because it's good, not because it's a romance or a science fiction. Like, yes, it happens to be one of those, but it can be a bad example of those and you won't enjoy it, or it can be a great example of a different genre and you'll enjoy it all the same. And yeah, that's why I love this so much, is because you do dabble into each of those genres. But so we always end our conversations with kind of one last question, and that's, what do you hope readers take away from reading The Absolute Book?
I want them to feel transported. I want them to feel like they've gone away from themselves and their lives, and they've been dwelling in a strange and wonderful country with endless possibility, and they've got to walk great distances through beautiful landscapes, and I want them to sort of just feel love for the world we're in, particularly the world of the forests and estuaries and so on.
Elizabeth,
marshland, very important. Save us from the sea when it starts coming for us.
Yeah. Well, since I finished it, I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. It's one of those books where I can't wait for my next read of it, because it's just so magical and fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. You're an ideal reader. Yay. It worked. It worked on you. Yay.
It worked in spades. It's so wonderful. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah. Thank you for talking to me. And yeah. And your dog seems to have sunk completely out of sight.
Of course.
No, behind you.
He's back there. Yeah. Now that we're done talking, he'll be quiet the rest of the time. Yeah.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.